Okay, let's go over our memory passage. Ready? Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Know ye that the Lord, he is God. It is he who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving and into his courts with praise. Be thankful unto him and bless his name, for the Lord is good. His mercy is everlasting, and his truth endures to all generations. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. That leads us to creation, right? And you're going to get an hour talk in 30 minutes. So hang on to your hats. That's why you have so many handouts. Creation, a hot topic, but not a new one. The concept of some type of naturalistic explanation for the origin of Earth, the universe, and its inhabitants has been around since the ancient Greeks. But it did not affect mainstream life until a couple of scientists promoted their ideas in books in the 1800s, Charles Lyell, and his idea was the old Earth, and of course Charles Darwin with his concept of biological evolution. But in 1925, mainstream life changed in America. The brand new ACLU decided to target a law in Tennessee that demanded evolution not to be taught in school. They found a man willing to be the scapegoat. His name was John Scopes. He was a substitute teacher for 2 weeks in a biology class, and he had never really taught evolution. And I do have a critique available for the fictitious play, Inherit the Wind. If your kids are studying it in school and you want to have a good critique about it, I've got that available for you as well. Well, the message pushed by the ACLU through the trial was that science is the new source of authority and truth, and the Bible is fallible, the simple fallible work of humans. Therefore, Christians must let scientists interpret anything that deals with origins. Well, religious leaders were paraded through the court saying, trust the scientists. And sadly, most religious leaders have done just that, even holding science as the absolute authority. Their concept is because humans wrote the Bible, including the book of Genesis, scriptures is just a human work, so Genesis cannot be taken literally. On the other hand, they claim that man's evolutionary theories are scientific fact and must be taken literally. That's why I have this cartoon here at the bottom. But they've got it the wrong way around. Man's theories are the human works. The Bible itself claims it is not. Well, leading scientists of the day were also paraded through the court, giving evidence proving evolution, supposedly. But most of that evidence has since been discarded or discredited, disproven, and that's on your handout. You can read that. They got it wrong. The religious leader said, trust the scientists, but the scientists got it wrong. So what's the result for you? What's the bottom line of this? The idea of evolution has become so firmly entrenched in our educational system and the media that most people merely assume that it is true. What's my point? I'm a geologist. That's someone who studies the earth. I became a Christian in college, and I felt torn between the two views. I couldn't believe all that the professors were teaching me, and yet Genesis is at the same time. I wanted to believe in creation, but I had no facts to encourage my faith. I went to geology summer camp in Colorado in 1972, and while there, I found a bookstore in Colorado Springs and found my very first creation science book called The Genesis Flood, which I read from cover to cover that summer, and it gave me the facts that I needed to be able to put what I visually saw everywhere I went in Colorado and everything I studied in perspective with what God said. And I've been interested in creation science ever since. You can tell this is something I'm excited about, can't you? Well, science is constantly changing, but the Word of God remains unchanged. Christians today are ensnared in the trap of not thinking critically. In the Bible, we read that God created all things in 6 days. But we've heard that all educated people know that evolution has been proven. So is it creation or evolution? The Bible or science? Do we compromise? And in your handout, fact sheet number two, there's a number of compromise positions that I've described for you, various ways that Christians have tried to reconcile the Bible and science, the gap theory, theistic evolution, progressive creation. I've given you information, what they mean, what they stand for, and some refutation with that so that you can read that later. We need to train ourselves to think, to be able to recognize the difference between scientific facts, which can be observed in the present, and ideas about the past, which can be used to interpret those facts. Okay, well, what is science? Science is the systematic observation of the world around us using our five senses. The qualities of true science are that it is testable, repeatable, and falsifiable. Where do fossils exist? In the past or in the present? They exist in the present. They lived in the past, but fossils exist in the present. Where do you exist? In the past or the present? You live in the present. You live in the present. The fossils exist in the present. Well, there are limitations of a scientist in the present. Certain limitations such as unique events. Just the word unique means it happened one time. It is not testable. It's not repeatable. It's a unique event. That's a limitation of a scientist. They cannot repeat it. It's a unique event. Non-measurable events or processes such as the rate of evolution. That's a non-measurable event. It happened supposedly in the past. Can't be measured. Can't be tested, can't be repeated. And then the past, anything that dealt with the past that doesn't have a written, literal historical record to back it up, scientists cannot repeat the past anyway, and they cannot test the past, except through the records that are given about it. No one can prove creation or evolution. You can look at the historical record and build a model. Then you examine your facts in light of that model, and when they don't agree, there may be a problem with the model or with the facts, that is how they were derived. We all have the same facts, but we come to those facts with different biases, different presuppositions. The evolution model is that it all happened by chance, and there's a totally naturalistic explanation for things. And evolution is inundating us in our current culture as though it was true. Evolution is a belief about the past to explain the evidence that only exists in the present. And the belief is based on the words of men who were not there in the past. Evolution is an untestable story about the past, and so it is not scientific. What is the biblical creation model? Well, it says there are three past events that affected Earth history from a scientific viewpoint, and one event that affected the history of the nations. You have the creation of all things by God in six ordinary days, and from our study today, you see that in Genesis, they were ordinary days. The curse on all things because of sin. All things are dying. Romans 8, 20 through 22 talks about the whole creation groaning because of sin. Catastrophe. The global flood of Noah's day deposited rocks and fossils. It affected Earth's surface for over 1 year. Then confusion at the Tower of Babel. The existing population was divided into language groups that spread out and repopulated the Earth. Our hypothesis for this course is that it is reasonable to consider the Earth to have been created in 6 days in a perfect state, affected by the curse and death after creation, then completely reshaped by a global flood all less than 10,000 years ago. Warning! Trouble! Problem! How can I believe in a young age for the Earth? Haven't scientists proven that the Earth is very old, billions of years? Well, what's the prevalent theory? Well, it's called the Big Bang. About 15 billion years ago, compressed matter exploded with a big bang. As this explosion took place, the elements in the periodic table cooked their way into existence and were hurled outward. They began to condense and to cool. Galaxies were formed as well as nebula. And then out of one of these spiral nebulas, a solar system condensed. And in this particular solar system, the planet Earth spun out about 4.5 billion years ago. What questions should you ask? What did God ask Job? Where were you? Were you there? From where did that matter come from? God questioned Job that. And that's the same question you can ask of anyone who gives you an explanation for the past. And even some non-Christian scientists reject the Big Bang theory today. What do the rocks say? Neither rocks nor fossils have birth dates stamped on them when they are collected. If you go out in the field and you find a rock and pick it up, you can look all around it. There is not going to be a date stamped on it. It doesn't have a barcode. So, how old are the rocks? How do you determine that? Well, there's several ways that scientists determine the age of rocks. The first way is by fossils. Fossils are dated by the false assumption of evolution. And so the idea of evolution demands old age. It had to take a very, very long time for evolution from a single cell organism to man. So you have to have old age represented in the rocks. So they start with the theory of evolution, and they date the rocks by the kinds of fossils in those rocks. Primitive fossils or advanced fossils. And even those categories are determined by scientists' concept of evolution. Then the fossils are dated by the sequence location of the rock in which it is found, such as in the Grand Canyon. The ones that are on the bottom are older than the ones on the top. That just makes sense, right? They had to be laid down first. They assume that it took a very, very, very long time to lay down all these rocks, millions and millions of years for each one of them. And so the fossils found here at the bottom are millions and millions of years older than the ones found on the top. They use the rocks to date the fossils. They use the fossils to date the rocks. It's a very circular argument, circular reasoning there. There's another way for dating rocks, and this is probably the one that you're most familiar with, even though you don't know it. These are called process clocks. And a process clock, you look at something, you observe and measure a present process. You assume that it acted the same way in the past, and this is called the law of uniformity. The present is the key to the past. And then you calculate the time necessary for that process to produce the present state. Example, the dust on your dresser. Let's say you find 2 inches of dust on your dresser. Now, in previous weeks or years, you have noticed that it takes about 3 weeks for a quarter inch of dust to accumulate on your dresser. You have 2 inches, so you've got 8 times that. Therefore, it took 24 weeks for that dust to accumulate on your dresser. That's a long time to go without dusting. However, you do not know whether your son had walked into your bedroom and shaken a whole thing of dust right above your dresser. You don't know if your husband had drilled something right above the dresser and dropped all that below as well. It may not have taken 24 weeks to do that, but this is called a process clock. The system or the clock that gives the oldest time is radioactivity. And the method is known as radioisotope dating. Only rocks that contain radioactive elements can be used for radioisotope dating. And these are the rocks such as lava, granite, basalt, things that were once molten that came out of volcanoes or else solidified underneath the earth. And the one that is the most used or best known example is that of uranium decay. Now, uranium-238 is a radioactive form of uranium. This particular element goes through a long series of radioactive decay processes, and I am not going to explain that to you. Just take my word for it. Eventually, it turns into lead, which is no longer radioactive. It's stable. So this particular process clock, if you found a rock that had uranium-238 and lead in it, let's say you found a rock and you measure how much of that is the uranium and how much of that is the lead. There's a certain ratio there. Now, they know that the decay rate from all the way from this uranium to this lead is about 4.5 billion years. And that means that half of this uranium-238 would have turned into a lead in 4.5 billion years. So you measure how much lead you have, compare that to the amount of uranium that you have, and you figure how long it's been for that uranium to change to lead. And that's how you get a date for that particular rock. But there are major assumptions involved. The four major assumptions. And these are things you're probably not aware of, but they're things that you can question. The first assumption is that there's been a constant decay rate all along, that nothing has changed, that uranium decaying to lead has been going the same measurable rate throughout pre-recorded history up to this date. Now, decay has only been measured in this century. So far, it stays pretty constant. This is one thing that is testable, and it remains pretty constant. We don't know if there's any major climatic things that affect the decay rate or the cooling of the Earth or anything like that in the past, but for this particular century, it remains constant. Well, the second assumption is that the system has been closed to environment. That means that that rock has not been exposed to groundwater leaching in uranium dissolved from somewhere else or leaching out lead from that rock to somewhere else. That there, it's not been exposed to the groundwater, to fog, to ice crystals, to bacteria, anything that would have affected that rock. Well, it is known that uranium can be leached into a rock, and so can lead, and both of them can be leached out of rocks. This is an untestable assumption. Unless you were there when the rock formed and tested it every week and actually observed what happened to that rock from beginning to end, you would not know that it had not been affected by any other process. So this particular assumption has some serious flaws in it. The third assumption is that there, you know the concentrations of both of them at the start. It is assumed that no lead was present in the rock when it formed, only the uranium. That is an assumption that is made at the beginning. However, it is observed in present-day volcanic eruptions that lead occurs naturally in rocks when they are formed. So this is something that can be seen in present-day rocks. And so this assumption has some questions about it. You don't know unless you were there when that rock formed how much of both of those elements were there. And then the fourth assumption is that enough time has passed to produce the present state through measured processes. In the case of your dresser, if you've lived in that house for 24 weeks, it is possible that you did not dust for 24 weeks. In the case of rocks, you haven't been around for 4.5 billion years to watch to make sure that that rock has been not affected by anything. So you are assuming that enough time has passed to produce the lead that you're seeing in that rock. But once again, time is history, and history cannot be observed scientifically. It's one of those things that cannot be tested. Remember that the radioisotope method for obtaining a substance formed in prehistory is theory. It is not a fact, it is theory, even though it's presented in all the media and books as though it's a sure thing. But it can only be theory because it can't be tested and repeated. An evolutionary scientist uses the dating method that gives the desired date of the sample. They already have in their mind an idea of how old they think the rock is, and they use the dating method that will give them a ballpark figure that agrees with the age that they already think the rock is. And rocks don't come with dates on them. You have to remember that as well. Well, how does it work? This is just a sample. Let's say you found a rock in your yard and you want it dated. Several different tests are performed on a sample rock. After time, results are given. There's a number of different kinds of methods. These are three popular ones. The uranium lead method, it tells you this rock is 500 million years old. The potassium argon method tells you this rock is 100 million years old. And the rubidium strontium method tells you that it's 325 million years old. So then the scientists will ask you, where did you find this rock? Were there any fossils in the rock, in a layer above or below or around it? And you say, yes, it had a fossil oyster in it. And then he will date the rock based upon the age of the evolutionary time of that oyster in the rock that's close by it and throw out any other dates. So let's say they dated the oyster at 100 million years. They say, oh, well, this rock is got to be, if it's underneath it, it's got to be older than 100 million years. So that's how, in very, very simple terms, how it's done. And they do throw out dates that don't coincide with the age of that particular fossil. Known examples of radioisotope failure on rocks of known dates. Sunset Crater in Arizona erupted in 1065 AD. The lava flows were dated by Indian records and tree rings by the potassium-argon method. That particular rock was dated at 210 to 230,000 years ago. So it just shows you that the method is not consistent. Mount Rangitoto in New Zealand, also seen to have erupted 300 years ago. And the potassium-argon method says it's 485,000 years old. In Grand Canyon, Vulcan's Throne, the lava there erupted within the last 2,000 years. They know that from records from the Indians that live in the area. But the potassium-argon method makes that rock 10,000 years old. That volcano in Hawaii, the people on the island watched the rock form during a volcanic eruption in 1801. The potassium-argon method dates it at 1 to 2.96 billion years old. And another method called that measures the amount of helium in the rock dates it at 140 to 670 million years. Mount Kilauea in Hawaii erupted less than 200 years ago, and the potassium-argon method dates those rocks at 21 million years. What's my point? Well, the conclusion is, it seems that whenever igneous rocks form today, they usually have daughter elements. That's what that end product is called, the daughter element. Those are already present. And so the rock already appears to be somewhat old. If this assumption doesn't work on those times when we can check it, how can we be confident that it works on those occasions when we cannot check it? Just something to think about. What about rocks of unknown age? Well, these are two rocks in the Grand Canyon area. This one on the bottom is definitely older than this one on the top, right? It's got all this other stuff on top of it. You would say it was older. Both of them are lava flows. There's one there, and there's one comes down from the top over there. The one on the top repeatedly dates older by a billion years or so by the various methods used than the one on the bottom. That doesn't make sense, does it? Well, radioisotope dating has not been disproved. I don't want to give you that idea at all, but it has been called into question, and flaws in its foundation have been exposed, and its results have shown to be inconsistent. But it is still a very formidable concept in the minds of many. A number of creationist scientists, PhDs, who are eminent scientists in their fields, are attacking the problems associated with radioactive dating. And they formed a committee this year to do a lot of research over the next few years. And they'll report back to us. They're analyzing every method used and all the assumptions. But until then, Bible-believing Christians need not be intimidated by radioisotope dating. Just don't be afraid about it. What about the age of the Earth? You may have heard that the Earth is supposedly 4.5 billion years old. Well, theories on the formation of the Earth vary, but all except special creation hold that the Earth was at one time a molten fireball. So those early rocks were so intensely reheated that they cannot be dated. But where did they get the age of 4.5 billion years? They get it from meteorites. Yeah. Supposedly, the sun and its planets condensed out of interstellar dust at the same time. Some meteorites are thought to be remnants of a planet that broke up after condensing. Therefore, meteorites are the same age as the Earth. So they find those meteorites, they date those meteorites, and they date the Earth based upon that. What about radiocarbon? That's another method that you may be more familiar with. This all may be new to you, but you may have heard of this one. Carbon-14 is a radioactive isotope of carbon. Cosmic rays from the sun bombard nitrogen in the upper atmosphere, producing carbon-14. And then it mixes with other carbon in the atmosphere, and it gets into the living systems, and it's taken in. When an organism dies, no more carbon-14 is taken in. And from there on, it decays. And it decays from carbon-14 to nitrogen. And over a period of 5,730 years, half of the original carbon-14 in anything that has died and is buried, only half of that remains. The carbon-12, all that's the same. That doesn't decay. So they know that the ratio of the carbon-12 to carbon-14, that ratio changes over time. But this can only be used for something that was once living or that contains carbon, such as skin, bones, trees. Coal can be dated this way. Anything that had once living substances in it. It's not used to date the earth or to date rocks. But you still have to take into consideration those same three assumptions. What about the constant decay rate? Well, it's testable, and the decay rate of carbon-14 is a constant decay rate. It's only been measured in this century. Based upon what we see, it is a constant decay rate. What about that there's no leaching in or out of the carbon-14 atoms in a substance? That is not testable still. There could be leaching in and out by groundwater through into any fossil, any kind of stuff that's buried. So that is not testable, and that's not a reasonable assumption. The third assumption is that you know the initial amount or the initial ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-14 because it's assumed that it's been constant through the years. However, now almost all investigators admit that the carbon-14 concentration in the atmosphere is constantly increasing. So years ago, we can't tell what the carbon-12 to carbon-14 ratio was based upon what it is today because it is constantly changing now. So that assumption cannot be considered valid. Now, some artifacts of known age have been measured, and as a result, a calibration curve is set up. By this, I mean they measure something that they know from historical record is a certain age. They measure the carbon-14 amount in that known thing, and they built a curve based on it so that they can take something that is not known, measure the amount of carbon-14 still present in that pottery, that bone, that skin, that anything, a mummy, stuff like that. Find out how much carbon-14 plotted on this line, and then go over here and you read that substance's age in years. If you notice, from 5,000 years on, it's dotted lines. That's because that's the oldest historically identifiable artifact that we have of known age. And beyond that requires speculation. So you have problems with anything beyond 5,000 years. It's all speculation beyond that point. And many times the carbon-14 dates on objects don't agree with historically derived ages, so many archaeologists prefer to date an artifact according to what he or she believes it is, according to what their concept of that history of that area is, rather than rely on carbon-14 results anyway. But it does have some validity because it can be tested against historical records. Yet there are some anomalies just to show that you can use this process clock and you're not going to get consistent results with it. Example, an Allosaurus, which is a type of dinosaur, excavated near Grand Junction, Colorado, in the same dinosaur layer that the Dinosaur National Monument is built in. It had bones that were heavily black and containing 3% carbon, which is an unusual thing for something that's supposedly that old anyway. The rock age, 140 million years, that's part of Jurassic Park. The carbon-14 age, less than 16,000 years. I'm just not saying that it was 16,000 years. I'm just showing you how the process is not consistent, even for evolutionists. A second example, a dinosaur found near Paluxy River, Glen Rose, Texas. The rock layer age, 99 million years. It's dated at Cretaceous, which is what you live on here, what we live on. The Woodbine sand here is dated at Cretaceous in the same time period. The carbon-14 age is less than 9,890 years. That's a pretty good size difference there in those bones. Example number three, carbonized wood from Glen Rose. It's in the same layer as the dinosaur footprints, which is the same 99 million years, Cretaceous age. Carbon-14 analysis is that it's about 12,000 years. It's just got some problems. What about coal? Coal from Russia, its rock layer age is 300 million years. Its carbon-14 age, 1,680 years. Just a big difference between what it should be and what it is. What about examples of living creatures? They have actually measured that. A freshly killed seal, carbon-14 analysis showed that it died 1,300 years ago. Living mollusks like clams and oysters shells and snail shells, they were over 2,000 years for the mollusk shells and 27,000 years for the snail shells. The conclusion is, well, environmental conditions do affect the carbon-12 to carbon-14 ratio in these of known age, When testing a sample of unknown age from a largely unknown environment, how can we exclude similar sorts of effects? It's just something to think about there. There are a couple other process clocks. I'm just going to quickly give you them. The strength of the Earth's magnetic field. This is one of the strongest evidences of a young Earth here, because this has been measured since 1829, and the magnetic field has been going down at an exponential decay. And so they can extrapolate back in history. And at 20,000 BC would have been its maximum, but life could not exist with the magnetic field at this strength. The optimum would be 10,000 or less for life to have existed. This is a strong evidence for a young Earth. Another one that bounced around by many scientists is the age of the atmosphere. There's not enough helium in our atmosphere for all the radioactivity that's supposedly been going on for 4.5 billion years. In radioactivity, helium is one of those products that's given off as the uranium and other atoms decay to the stable daughter elements. There's not enough in our atmosphere. There's too much in the crust. Helium is a light gas. It should go right through all the pores and get up to the atmosphere very easily. There's still too much in the Earth's crust. They can't explain it. Based upon this information, the Earth could not be any older than 2 million years. I'm not saying it's 2 million years. I'm just giving you information that shows it's not as old as we have heard it said. And of course, if God did create the world as he said he did in Genesis 1:1, our biblical model would give us a list of things that would have apparent age. As we study it, you'll see it. There are certain things that he created with certain age. If you went back on that very day of creation, it would look very old because it was already mature, fully functioning from the beginning. So, bottom line is, how do you interpret what you read in here? First of all, you look for the facts. You discern the facts from interpretation. You question the assumptions used to derive the facts and or the interpretations. And you consider the same facts with the assumptions of biblical history. Example in this little article about chilled crawfish. Ordering crawdads on ice has a new meaning now that geologists have found the oldest fossil crawfish ever in Antarctica. Two facts. Fossil crawfish in Antarctica. What's an assumption in here? Okay, assumption is it's the oldest. That's an assumption. The discovery of the 280 million year old crustacean, an assumption right there, that's an assumption, suggests that the climate around the South Pole was relatively balmy at the time. That's also an assumption. It doesn't have to be balmy for crawfish to live, at least in the streams and lakes where crawdads live. Only later did the continent freeze out the crawfish. A team led by so-and-so reported on this last month in geology. The scientists found just a fragment of the ancient crawfish. That's a fact. They found a fragment in the transantarctic mountains in the central part of the continent. The fossil was part of a claw that had been gnawed on by a predator, perhaps in a search for a primitive etouffee. The researchers also found large burrows dated to about 240 million years old. Years ago. Okay, there you've got an assumption that the burrows are that old. You also have an assumption that these are crawfish burrows because they probably didn't have their name on it, but they did find burrows. The burrows indicate that crawfish had evolved their social activity much earlier than scientists had thought. There's an assumption. The fact that crawfish could live in the lakes of Antarctica at the time supports other evidence that Antarctica was experiencing a warming trend at the time. Well, it obviously was warmer than it is now. This fits in with biblical history. Antarctica would have been warm enough for crawfish. This fits with the biblical history. So does the thing about the warming. Up here fits in with biblical history. So that's what you do. You look for the facts and get rid of the assumptions. If you start with the assumption of evolution in the old Earth, you're looking at the same data, the same fossils, same rocks. Your interpretations will be consistent with evolution in the old Earth, and all evidence other than that will be explained away. If you start with the assumption of biblical history, you'll look at the same data, the same rocks, the same fossils, and you'll see interpretations consistent with the Bible. It all depends upon how you start out. This particular quote I have on your handout, I'm not going to read it. But one point to consider, if you accept millions of years, you're accepting death before Adam. And if physical death is not the penalty for sin, there was no reason for Jesus to die on a cross, and the resurrection has absolutely no meaning for us. So let's pray. Father, thank you that you give us enough facts to where we can believe your word just as it is written. Thank you, and we praise you for who you are and what you've done. Amen.